My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and a special thank you at the top of the show to anyone who tuned into our previous episode dedicated to Synchronicity, the final studio album by The Police. I'm a huge fan of The Police and Sting, and it was great to finally talk about one of their albums on the podcast. Damon Johnson, who many of you will remember from his time in Brother Kane, Black Star Riders and Thin Lizzy, chose the album to talk about, and yeah, I think it was one of my favourite episodes that we've done. We had a couple of technical difficulties, which kind of sucked, but beyond that, I loved chatting with Damon, and there was a lot of love for the episode on social media. People really got behind it, so thank you to anyone who listened to it. If you haven't, it's still available online at myclassicalbum.co.uk, as are all of our previous episodes. So we're up to episode 30 today of My Classic Album, 30 classic albums that we've looked back on. And I can genuinely say that all 30 are phenomenal albums. You know, I would recommend any of the albums that we've covered on the podcast so far, from Revolver by the Beatles that we did right back at the start, right through to today, Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They're all just excellent albums, and the people that have chosen them are supremely talented singers and musicians. So if you haven't had a chance, go and check some of these guys out that I'm chatting to on the podcast. You know, go and check out Damon Johnson, who chose Synchronicity. Absolutely go and check out Hannah Wickland, who is my guest today. She is singer and guitarist with Hannah Wickland and the Stepping Stones. And when I heard her music for the first time, I was like, she is awesome. I've got to go and check out this band. And dropped her an email to say she'd be interested in taking part in the podcast, and thankfully she was. And it's funny, because sometimes people really struggle to choose an album. You know, they'll have two or three that they're like, well, I'm not sure which one I want to do. And that's a dialogue that we go, right, well, how about this one? Whereas sometimes they're very definite that this is the album. This is definitely it. So Blaze Bailey, when I had him on the show, he knew that it was Holy's Ivor by Dio. He knew that was the album he wanted to talk about. And similarly, Hannah straight away knew that Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers was the album for her to talk about on the podcast. It's an album that has some kind of personal links to her too, which you'll hear about, which is really cool. And it's just got a phenomenal story. You know, some of my favourite episodes of the podcast is when I delve into the history of an album, and there's just such a cool story behind the songs and the production of the album and the band at that point. And that's why I started the podcast. And Damn the Torpedoes is a great example of, in some ways, an unbelievable story as to what happened to the band around this time and how Tom kind of was a trailblazer in a lot of ways in getting this album released on his terms. So that's my chat with Hannah Wickland coming up very soon indeed. But in a couple of weeks' time, we are finally going to be looking at an album by Metallica. Now, I'm so excited for this. Anyone who knows me will know that I'm a huge Metallica fan. And I guess the only criticism that I maybe had of the albums that we did earlier in the podcast's run, kind of series one, was that we didn't really touch on sort of the heavier side of things. You know, we did Hysteria by Def Leppard. We did Hotter Than Hell by Kiss. But I felt like really, other than that, we weren't really getting into kind of the heavy metal side of things. You know, so to finally touch on some of these heavier albums, like we did Shout with the Devil a couple of months ago, we did Holy Diver by Dio, but I've just been like, where are we going to do a Metallica album? And my prayers have been answered. Calvin Lever, guitarist with Night Screamer, has chosen Metallica's Black Album, so their self-titled 1991 album, which is just called the Black Album by, like even the band call it the Black Album, just the world over, that's what it's renowned as. And it's an album that changed heavy metal in a lot of ways. It was a huge turning point for the band. And, you know, some people hate this album. You know, the hardcore Metallica fans who love the Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning days, they hate the Black Album. But then there's millions and millions of people who got into Metallica and heavy metal as a result of this album. It is a groundbreaking album. It's very important to the development of metal. And I'm excited that we're finally going to be doing it. So Calvin and I will be chatting about the Black Album in just a couple of weeks' time. And you can access that in all usual places. Very, very excited for that one. So without further ado, let's just get on with the main focus of today. We're going to be looking at Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. My special guest who chose the album is Hannah Wickland. But before we get to Hannah and my chat with her about the album, here are the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Damn the Torpedoes. Released on the 20th of October, 1979, Damn the Torpedoes is the third studio album from American rock band Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. The album was recorded between Sound City Studios and Cherokee Studios in California, with Jimmy Iovine and Tom Petty behind the production desk. When the band's recording contract was assigned to MCA Records, a long and ugly legal battle began between Tom and the label, which delayed the release of the album considerably. After funding the production costs himself and declaring bankruptcy as a result, Tom was able to negotiate a better deal for the Heartbreakers, and Damn the Torpedoes was finally released on Backstreet Records. Don't Do Me Like That was the first single released from the album. In spite of strong airplay in the UK, the single failed to chart in the top 75. However, in America, the single proved to be a huge hit for the band. Don't Do Me Like That reached number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100, signalling the breakthrough that so many had predicted for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Second single, Refugee, had similar success in the US, charting at number 15. The single saw huge success in Canada too, reaching number 2 on their RPM Top Singles chart, while only charting at number 59. Third single, Here Comes My Girl, continued the momentum for Damn the Torpedoes in the US. Australia were lucky enough to host a single release for Even the Losers, with the song proving a big hit over there. While the singles didn't make a huge impression in the UK, Damn the Torpedoes did chart at number 57 on the UK album charts. The album reached number 2 in both Canada and the US, only being held off the top of the Billboard 200 by Pink Floyd's The Wall. With sales of over 3 million in the US alone, Damn the Torpedoes has been certified 3 times platinum in the band's home country, with 2-time platinum certification in Canada. The album was the instant breakthrough expected of the band, and has gone down in history as a defining moment in the career of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. AllMusic.com called Damn the Torpedoes one of the greatest records of the album rock era, while Rolling Stone placed it 313th on their 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list in 2003. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Damn the Torpedoes, and I have here with me a very special guest today who chose the album that we're going to be chatting about. This is Hannah Wickland. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you very much. Before we get started, why have you chosen Damn the Torpedoes to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers have always been kind of like our guiding light as a family. I come from a very musically rich family. And Damn the Torpedoes was, one, it was the album that really got my dad into playing drums, which my dad was catalyst behind my brother, who also has a band, and me, you know, getting so into music. So Damn the Torpedoes really was kind of like an introduction for all of us at some point in our lives to music. So that's why I chose it.
So obviously, I know you said that there's really strong family oriented memories around that album for you. Do you have any memories of hearing it for the first time, or what are those initial memories that you've got of hearing the album?
You know, I don't think I have never been one to be able to draw back to the first time that anything really has happened. But for me, I think that this record was the one that really set the tone for what Tom Petty's sound was for the rest of his career. You know, I think this is really the biggest power punch of all of his stuff, in my opinion. I think Refugee has got to be, it's always been in my top 3 Tom Petty songs of all time. So I think that song just has so much grit, and it takes such a stance and really highlights his way with words.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, Damn the Torpedoes is the third studio album from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but their story begins 3 years earlier in 1976. So the Heartbreakers came out of the ashes of the band Mudcrutch, who played together throughout the 70s but achieved less success. Tom formed the Heartbreakers shortly after, and he recruited many of those Mud Crutch bandmates, including Mike Campbell on lead guitar and Ben Montench on keyboards.
My favorite.
Yeah. Have you heard much, if any, of Mud Crutch's music from that time? And how important are they to the sound that you said would be starting to develop on Damn the Torpedoes?
I am familiar with Mud Crutch, and it was actually after one of the Tom Petty concerts that I went to with my family. My dad had known the history with like Mud Crutch and everything, but I had gotten handed like a pamphlet basically highlighting their new record. So that's when I went back and dove in and discovered, you know, so to speak, Mud Crutch. You know, I think that Mud Crutch obviously played a huge role in Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You know, they definitely had a far more like swampy southern kind of sound about them. So I think the 3 years in between Mud Crutch and Heartbreakers was really where Tom kind of buttoned up and I feel like he got a little bit more commercial, which I love. I don't think commercial is a bad word.
No.
And I think that's, to me, the biggest difference. But I think that the underlying tone and, like, you know, the content is still very similar between the two.
So not necessarily at the time, but retrospectively, the band gets associated with this genre that people called Heartland Rock. So for those who are unfamiliar, this kind of almost straightforward rock and roll with elements of Southern, like you'd said, and maybe even a bit of country rock in there as well. So people like Bruce Springsteen and Bob Seger are often thrown into this Heartland Rock genre. Do you think that that's a good description of what the Heartbreakers were all about? Or I guess kind of during the mid to late 70s, you could argue that they were a huge part of establishing that sound.
I think that they're definitely at the epicenter of that. You know, I haven't myself used the term, you know, like Heartland Rock before, to be honest. But when you group them together, Tom Petty and Springsteen and Seger definitely go hand in hand, in my opinion. And they really are from that straight ahead, you know, rock zone, like where the drums aren't, you know, the drums aren't throwing in any crazy fills. The drums, I think, play a huge part in the sound of those three, where, you know, because Stan Lynch is just holding it down, very, you know, kind of like deceivingly simple drum parts and just like the right things in the right places. So that really throws a lot of the emphasis on the lyrics, which all three of those songwriters are writing about kind of the American experience, and they're writing about, you know, incredible storytellers. And I think storytelling has a lot to do with that genre.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've talked a little bit about kind of Mud Crutch and then this album and the journey between the two. The two previous albums that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers released with Shelter Records were, of course, their self-titled debut and 1978's You're Gonna Get It. I'm guessing that you'll have listened to those earlier albums. How do you think that they differ from Damn the Torpedoes? I know you'd say earlier that this was the album where they really made a statement about who they were as a band.
Well, I think Damn the Torpedoes is where they really kind of congealed and had, like, everything was kind of jumping off the page. You know, I think when You're Gonna Get It came out, I Need to Know is still, you know, that's one of the best Tom Petty songs, in my opinion, too. So it's not really a matter of his songwriting was already super strong, but I don't know. I mean, that's a great record, too. I don't really know exactly how they transformed, so to speak, but that record is a little less in your face, I think.
So it seems at this point that while they had quite a loyal following in the UK, they were struggling to gain traction in the US. And I don't know if you've seen the TV series Classic Albums, and they did an episode dedicated to this album. And Ben Montench actually talked about his experience trying to get their songs played on the radio. So he said, "I remember calling a local radio station, wanting to hear myself and saying hi, putting on a fake voice. Would you play American Girl by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers? And the station saying, 'We don't play that shit.'"
Wow, I did not know that.
Exactly, yes. Funny. For some reason, they just weren't connecting over there as they were here in the UK, where for some reason we really latched onto them early on.
You know, that's definitely been a trend with American musicians. I don't know exactly. I wish I was alive back then and could know exactly what was wrong with everyone and why they weren't embracing them, you know, with the first two records. But it's hilarious because, you know, they weren't being embraced over here then. But as soon as everything caught on and caught fire, their last two records now people love, you know, and then those songs then got their shining light and they're like, "Oh my God, American Girl, best song ever," you know. So it's funny how that happens. But I don't know. I think Tom always had a kind of a I don't give a fuck attitude, and maybe that just hit home in Europe and UK a little bit more than it did in America.
Yeah, we'll definitely touch on that attitude as we go on, because it is really integral to kind of the story of this album as it unfolded. So Denny Cordell had produced the band's first two albums, and it was Denny who suggested Jimmy Iovine to the band to produce this album. So Jimmy had worked as an engineer on Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, that we actually did an episode on a few months ago now, and he also produced the Patti Smith Group's Easter in 1978. Now, Jimmy's spoken in the past of his excitement to work with the band and how he felt the time was right for them to have the breakthrough they'd worked so hard for. What does Jimmy bring to the album, and how does his production help Damn the Torpedoes stand out? I know we were talking about the drum sound, and I know that Jimmy often gets very much associated with that kind of drum sound that we're talking about in these Heartland rock albums.
Well, I think that has a huge, you know, like I already mentioned before, you know, and the way that like the snare drum is tuned, it's super big and fat. So the definitely like the tonal quality of the album, like I said, I keep describing it as kind of the record that like jumped out, because I think that the production on this one, it was kind of, I don't know if lighthearted is the way to approach it, but it's very useful. I feel like Jimmy Iovine captured like the basics and really like elevated things, but I think it kept, you know, kind of like it kept trucking, like that kind of a rhythm about it.
So just as the band were getting ready to get the ball rolling on production, ABC Records, who were the distributors for Shelter Records that they were signed to, was sold to another label, MCA Records. Now, this was a deal which included Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers record deal. And Tom took exception to being, as he put it, being bought and sold like a piece of meat. And he tried to find a way out of his contract. So I've got a quote from Tom from Rolling Stone magazine after the fact, trying to describe what it was that made him so angry about the situation. So he says, it was the principle. The idea of being told to report to those guys really pissed me off. Plus, it was the knowledge that we would remain under that old deal, which wasn't worth shit. I could work my ass off for the rest of my life, and for every dime I saw, the people that set me up would have seen 10 times as much. And at that point, MCA's attitude was, we know your next album's going to be bigger than your last, and we got you, the deal's done. And again, it's this, you know, that's a horrible situation to be in, but we're just beginning to see, as you were saying, that this attitude that Tom Petty's got, that he'll do what he wants, he doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, well, I mean, he hid the tapes from them, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
You know, I mean, he went to such great lengths, you know, to protect his art, and he's always had, you know, no problem standing up to the big guy. You know, like he's definitely got that funk about him where, you know, if someone's trying to mess with him, that's what I've always admired about him, because it's hard in this industry because so many people want to protect their image and like care so much about what people think about them that a lot of times they'll sacrifice things just to fear, you know, public opinion or something. And so I think it's really incredible how Tom, I mean, he went through, he claimed bankruptcy just to get out of this. I mean, he went through some great lengths to protect this record and keep his rights the way that he wanted them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I've got here is that the drastic measures that he took, I think initially he thought that there was a clause in their agreement that meant that they could talk to other record companies, but MCA would then go on to sue him for that. So then his action was, as you'd said, he financed the production of the album himself to the tune of $500,000, refused to let them release it. And did you say before he had like a studio assistant hide the tapes in different places so he would never know? He would never know where they were.
Yeah, so he wouldn't lie under oath if he was asked if he knew where the tapes were.
Which is just so, it's so clever. It's so cerebral.
It is.
You know.
It is.
And then, obviously, he's financed this album to, $500,000 is a lot of money now. It was even more so then. And then he declares himself bankrupt, which he would hope would void his contract. I mean, as far as I can guess, would he have been the first person to have done something like that? Because you hear stuff like that now, but I think surely that was the first time that someone had done something like that.
I know he was one of the first people that really stood up to the record companies and stood up to, you know, the man in such a big, grandiose way. I mean, he's always one of my favorite songs by Tom, even though it's not on Damn the Torpedoes, is Joe, because it's just such a fuck you to the record companies and really spells out what he thinks of them and what he continued to think about the business, you know, later on in his life. It seems as if it didn't get much better from that point on.
So obviously we've got these, for lack of a better term, kind of business constraints going on while the album's being recorded. And these legal wars would cause difficulties within the band. So particularly between Tom and drummer Stan Lynch to the point where Stan briefly left the group. So Rolling Stone documented their struggles during the time, said Petty stayed and sat up with the band all night, huddling about their dilemma. Finally, at 6 a.m, he agreed to call Stan. I said, Stanley, are you mad? I think we made a mistake. It's the five of us or nothing. At 4 the next afternoon, when Petty arrived at Sound City Studios, Lynch was already there, belligerent and drunk. He and Petty got into a yelling match, and Lynch quit a second time. By midnight, he was back. So it's not a huge stretch to suggest that all of this going on, you know, this is an album that nearly didn't even get made.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of heated moments. Stan Lynch is still, you know, he's such a great drummer and was very simple. Their personal inner relationships definitely came to a head.
Absolutely. And for anyone who's kind of wondering what the end of this story was with Tom filing for bankruptcy and all that, the label caved and they then re-signed him to a much more lucrative contract because they wanted this album out, you know, and it is such a strong album. We'll go through the tracks in a minute, but Tom stuck to his guns. They, you know, released the album on his own label, Backstreet, and it was a rare victory. Even now, I'd say a rare victory in a very cutthroat business. And as we'd said before, you know, this great example of an artist protecting their art and keeping and getting what's rightfully theirs.
That's right. You go, Tom.
But while all this, that is fascinating stuff, I don't want it to overshadow the music on the album, which, as I said, we'll explore more as we go track by track. But do you think it could be argued that because the band and Jimmy Iovine knew they had such a strong album, that they did have that upper hand in their dispute with MCA because they knew how badly they would want it to be put out?
Oh, 100%. And, you know, things like this just create good art. Anytime there's conflict in your life, and especially, I think, when you have something to prove, if you're trying to prove someone wrong, it's just going to feel that much better. And you're going to usually get something just that much better. So I think it's undeniable. I think, you know, Refugee, I actually, one of the assistant engineers on the record, Skip Saylor, and I've met with him and I talked with him about that song, actually. And they knew, basically, you know, that they didn't necessarily know that Refugee was going to be the big, big hit, but they knew that that one was, you know, a shoo-in. So I think, yeah, I think they knew, of course.
So a lot has been said about the album's success against the backdrop of the other genres that were big at the time. So disco was huge at the time, for example, and punk was really coming through. Ultimate Classic Rock goes far to say that the record sparked rock and roll during a period in which punk and disco almost killed it. Do you think that Damn the Torpedoes is an important album in that respect for keeping rock alive when a lot of the other rock bands were really struggling against the likes of punk and disco?
You know, I would definitely credit them. I wish I knew more firsthand. Being young, it's hard to know exactly the climate. I know what the bands were definitely sounding like rounding into the 80s, and Tom was definitely a standout. But yeah, I don't know if rock and roll would have maintained that bright spot in rock and roll if Tom hadn't brought it there.
So upon its release, Damn the Torpedoes was the breakthrough hit that the band, Jimmy Iovine and MCA had all expected that it would be. Rolling Stone's review at the time said, "This is the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers album we've all been waiting for. That is, if we were all Tom Petty fans, which we would be if there were any justice in the world. Live shows for all, free records everywhere, and rock and radio." Looking back, 40 years, and it is 40 years this year since the album came out, how important is this album in shaping the foundation of everything that was to come for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers throughout their career?
Oh, I think it was extremely important. This is like their breakout. This is the one that really, I think, latched, you know, America onto the Tom Petty bandwagon and really set his platform up in the way that, you know, he was able to stay relevant and on top and be respected his entire career. So, you know, I think if you look back at anybody who has had a career like that, you know, there's definitely a defining point where they took that step up, and Damn the Torpedoes was that moment where it was just absolutely undeniable, you know, his songwriting and the tightness of the band, and, you know, like they say, the live show was phenomenal. So yeah, I think this one was extremely important and pivotal in his career. I'm happy he made this record.
Absolutely. Well, head track by track, we've touched on Refugee a bit already, and that's our opening track. It was written by Tom and guitarist Mike Campbell. Uncut Magazine say of the song, "Whether your tastes are into black metal or sampled bird song, there can't be many whose pulse isn't quickened by the opening riffs of Refugee and the swelling Hammond B3 of Benmont Tench." So your thoughts on Refugee? I mean, you'd said one in your top three Tom Petty songs of all time? How does it fare as an album opener for you?
No, I think it's a perfect opener. Like they mentioned, you know, Ben Mott playing his organ on this song in particular is just so, you know, painstakingly prevalent. You know, I think it's a natural born opener to a record.
Yeah, so the guitar sound on Refugee is heavily influenced by John Mayall's version of Oh Pretty Woman, which features Mick Taylor on guitar before his days in the Rolling Stones. Mike Campbell told Classic Rock magazine, "I just put it on and practiced guitar along with it. I love the way Mick Taylor plays, and maybe some of it's rubbed off." Can you hear the influence of someone like Mick Taylor on the track? Do you think there's kind of a Rolling Stones-ish feel to it?
Yeah, I could totally hear it. I mean, it's a very chord-heavy kind of a riff, which is definitely what the Rolling Stones were about. And yeah, I could totally hear that.
So Tom's since revealed that Jimmy Iovine made the band record over 100 takes of Refugee to get the perfect performance, rather than using any studio trickery or overdubs to pick the best of various takes. So in this case, of course, it worked. But I mean, obviously, your experience being in the studio, and I know that in 40 years, kind of the technology in studios has changed dramatically. But that must have been such a laborious task in that studio environment to get 100 takes of that song to make sure that it had the right feel.
I would love if somebody made me play something 100 times. That would mean that somebody really, really cares, one, in what we're doing, and cares and believes that you can do it better. I think, you know, there's some songs that you nail on the first take, and then there's some that you gotta fucking hound into the ground. But not using any studio trickery, I think, is the key to Tom's sound and why Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and the Rolling Stones and Hendrix, and why all of those records, you know, they're not using any studio trickery. There's no magic button there. They're all just playing together in a room, and the music actually lives and breathes that way. So I think that's a huge component. I'm happy Jimmy Iovine did that, you know?
So it proved so frustrating for Mike Campbell that he actually had to walk away briefly, not leave the band, but kind of leave that studio environment just to get some space from the situation. So he said in an interview with Song Facts in 2003, "I remember being so frustrated with it one day that, and I think this is the only time I ever did this, I just left the studio and went out of town for 2 days. I just couldn't take the pressure anymore. But when I came back and when we regrouped, we were actually able to get it down on tape. I guess that's really important. To try and get some kind of distance from it, so hopefully you'll get kind of a better perspective of it when you return." You know, is there that kind of feeling sometimes, again, when you say some of these songs come down straight away and other ones that you really have to work for? Is it worth sometimes just walking away for a couple of days, going somewhere else, getting some air, taking a break from it all, and then coming back and seeing what you can do with it when you return?
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of the recording process, because things can definitely boil over, and I've never done that myself, and maybe I need to take a page from Mike's book and do that next time I'm frustrated in the studio.
So while they got the song they wanted in the end, it seems like it's always been a challenging song to replicate in a live setting. So I've read a couple of interviews where, with Refugee being at the back end of the set, if Tom was struggling vocally, it wasn't unknown for him to maybe drop it from the set list that night. What makes it such a tough song, particularly if you have already been singing for a couple of hours? I mean, I know it's in quite a high register.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. His a lot of his, you know, songs that he did when he was younger are in higher keys than the ones that he did when he was, you know, a little older in life. So, yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Refugee was one of two songs from the album that reached the top 20 of the Billboard Hot 100. So I think it reached number 15. And as we've said, it was an integral part of their live shows, and a really, you know, one of the breakthrough hits for the band that made them who we know them as today. You've started to touch on this already. What is it about this song that's just made it connect with so many people over the past 40 years?
Like I said, I think it's just the message. I think it's an extremely relatable message. But I think it was also the first, he was one of the first people, it's a very strong language, you know, like Refugee, don't correct me if I'm wrong, I wasn't alive, but it doesn't seem as if the word refugee was being thrown around or being used as much as it is, you know, these days. I feel like back then that term itself was ear catching. So, you know, through the years, I think it's signified, you know, many different things for many people. But I think initially it was, as it sounded, it was kind of a jarring, you know, perspective.
And that's Hannah Wicklin there chatting with me about her chosen classic album, Damn the Torpedoes. And we're going to get back to my chat with Hannah in just a little bit. I'd love to know your thoughts on the album. Absolutely get involved with the show on social media. You can like our page at My Classic Album with Mike Norris. You can follow us on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And please, just let me know what you think about the show in general. I love it when people kind of let me know that they're listening, that they're enjoying it. It's awesome. Coming up, how does a story from one of Tom's childhood friends give Even the Losers a special significance for Hannah? And which song on the album was nearly given away to the Jay Giles Band? All that and more right after this.
Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Bloater.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
So we'll move on to Here Comes My Girl. So it's another collaboration between Tom and Mike. Here Comes My Girl was written on the same week as Refugee, and Tom initially struggled with the lyrics to go with Mike's music, but ended up going with a narrative style in the verses rather than a more conventional vocal. What do you make of that narrative style, and do you think it helps the song stand out amongst the rest of the album?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's definitely more like talky kind of a song, which I think it's important on a record to have songs that have very different characteristics about them, and that's what keeps your ear entertained for the hour or the 45 minutes. But yeah, I think it's interesting with Tom's writing on this song. It's very internal, so he's kind of questioning himself and stuff, but it's still done in a storyline, which he does so well.
So I feel that narration really helps the vocals in the chorus stand out, you know, and that's what kind of contributes to it being one of my favourite songs on the album. It is a really catchy chorus that against those kind of narrative verses, I think it
kind of... You like the dichotomy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think it makes it shine stronger than if he'd maybe had a more conventional verse. I think it just helps that chorus really stand out.
No, that's a brilliant point. I can agree to that.
Tom said in the past that the chorus was actually inspired by the Birds. I mean, do you have much knowledge of the Birds? Can you hear that inspiration on the chorus of a song like Here Comes My Girl?
I love the Birds, and I could certainly see that. That makes total sense.
So readers of Rolling Stone magazine placed Here Comes My Girl 9th in their poll of Tom Petty's 10 best songs in 2013. Refugee was also on that chart. It was at number 3. You know, does this song rank with the likes of, you know, Free Fallin' and American Girl? These songs were all also in the chart. Do you feel that Here Comes My Girl stands toe-to-toe with those songs? Is it a stronger track on the album for you?
Certainly. I mean, this song I remember from my childhood many different points. It's kind of a very sweet sentiment, you know? It's rare that there's like a rock and roll song out there that's like, you know, kind of mushy-gushy that you don't think is corny, you know? So I've always loved and respected that about this song. Yeah, I think it deserves that number 9 spot. That seems pretty accurate.
So Even the Losers is our next track. So the songwriting credits for the rest of the album are credited solely to Tom, and that starts with this one. So despite only being released in Australia, it's seen by many as a high point on the album. So Rolling Stone ranked it 19 in its list of Tom Petty's greatest songs, which was different to the readers' polls that we were talking about earlier there. Uproxx ranked it at number 15, and the Washington Post included it on their list of Tom Petty's 10 best songs. Would you agree with that critical praise? Is it really a high point of the album?
Definitely. I mean, it's a perfect chorus. I would think it would be higher than, like, what did you say? It was number 19 on some list?
Yeah, Rolling Stone. Yeah, Rolling Stone had it 19. But then the Washington Post had it, like, in their top 10. So that seems a bit...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this song to me is, again, just another example of why Tom is so relatable, you know? He's, you know, maybe even the losers get lucky sometimes. It's like, you know, you could listen to that as a person from any background and just be like, yeah, I've felt like a loser before. So to me, that's where I focus on stuff. I mean, all of the music and all of that is, you know, very, very important that I pay attention to. But a lot of times what draws me to songs is what they're saying. And he's such an optimist. It's wonderful.
And it's funny you're talking about being relatable. I guess that's how I feel about it. That part of the strength of that song is, as many of his songs are, they're just so hugely relatable. And they're naturally, that's just going to make people gravitate towards it when they are listening to the lyrics, like you say, which so many of us do. You know, obviously this podcast, we do touch on the music side of it, but obviously lyrically, you know, that's how most people kind of listen to music and fall in love with it.
Oh, yeah. And there's actually, so in the verse of Even the Losers Get Lucky Sometimes, he talks about standing on the overpass and the water looking like glass. And we actually have a family friend whose dad was best friends with Tom growing up. And that part in that song is about Tom and his best friend in Gainesville tripping acid for the first time. It was the night that Tom tripped acid for the first time. And that's what he was writing about, because they were just standing on an overpass in Gainesville, Florida. And so it's, for me, it's really cool because, you know, I know a story of like where his lyrics come from, which just, you know, leads me to believe that everything that he writes about, he's drawing from his real life. And so this song has a lot of heart in it. You know, it's a good one.
Yeah. And I love stories like that. I think that's absolutely amazing. In an article published after Tom's death in 2017, Uproxx claimed that despite not being his most well-known song or one that was played a lot live particularly, that Even the Losers sums up Petty's career more than any other track in his hit-stuffed discography. That's quite a bold statement. Would you agree with that? Do you think the song is quintessential Tom Petty?
So, you know what? Yeah, I do. I think so. Because, like, you know, it has the message and it has, like, the music behind it that almost makes it sound like they're floating along. You know, that's the thing with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers as a band, like musically, you know, they have some songs that just feel as if they're on, you know, on auto, like the band is just trucking along, and this is one of them. So I think it has the musical staple and it has the lyrical staples behind it, and he probably would consider himself a loser that got lucky too, so there's that.
And it's funny you talk about kind of the musicianship in it. Music Radar said, save the song, want to know how a five-piece band should play together? This track is required listening, which again is a really bold statement. But it's like you say, just it's one of those instances where a band and the lyrics and everything just come together to make an amazing song. Again, it's one of my favorites on the album, but I could say that about a few, to be honest.
Yeah, that's the problem. When you go track by track, everyone becomes your favorite.
Yeah. So there's two great stories coming out of this one. Mike Campbell initially struggled with the guitar solo on the song, only for Tom to ask him, well, what would Chuck Berry do? And within minutes, that solo was recorded, and that's what we hear on the album.
That's what you need sometimes. Like, as a guitar player, you need somebody to make you think about something in a different light. So that's interesting. Yeah, I know. I definitely see a lot of, I don't know, bridges between Mike Campbell's playing and Chuck Berry. I mean, one of the things that I love about Mike Campbell's guitar playing is his double bends. You know, he always seems to be playing, you know, he does some singular note stuff, but he loves like double bends and keeping some chunk behind the lead. You know, it's kind of like rhythmic lead playing sometimes.
And so also there is, at the start of the song, there's a female voice that says, it's just the normal noises in here, which is quite a famous part of the song. So for those who don't know, who are listening, the voice is from the demo of the song that Mike recorded in his home. So he was complaining to his wife about the noise from the washing machine as he was recording the demo, and her reply was, it's just the normal noises in here. And somehow, they obviously got a kick out of that, and that's what made the album. And that's the story behind that kind of little intro that we got
that's
the song.
Cool. I didn't know that.
So we'll move on to Shadow of a Doubt, A Complex Kid. Some of the albums that we talk about on My Classic Album, there's the odd track where it's like filler or a deep cut or whatever. And I genuinely feel that Damn the Torpedoes doesn't have any filler at all. But Classic Rock Review share some mild criticism for Shadow of a Doubt. So they say, the first less than excellent track on the album, Shadow of a Doubt, is a slightly upbeat lover's lament tune, which lacks the succinct delivery of much of the rest of the album's material. Do you feel like it's a step down from what we've heard before? Or do you think that's just criticism for criticism's sake?
I feel like you have to criticize something, but I think it's important to not have every song on a record doesn't have to, nor should it be a in-your-face single, you know, like the catchiest chorus that you've ever heard. But no, I think Shadow of a Doubt is totally deserving of as much praise as the rest of the record.
I mean, I really like the song, but I'm aware that I think I've said that for every song so far. bestclassicbands.com called Shadow of a Doubt and our next track, Century City, full throttle rockers. And I think Shadow of a Doubt is a great example of how great the Heartbreakers sound on this album. And, you know, that drum sound that we're talking about, you know, I feel like the band are really benefiting from Jimmy's production. And I think you can hear that really well on this track.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very clean, they're very clean, full ahead rock songs, you know?
I mean, when the album was released, Robert Christgau claimed that Damn the Torpedoes is a breakthrough for Petty because for the first time, the Heartbreakers are rocking as powerfully as he's writing. Would you say that Shadow of a Doubt is a strong example of what Robert's getting at? Or do you think there's other tracks where that's kind of displayed more vividly?
Oh, I think Shadow of a Doubt is definitely highlighting that. I think there's a lot of, like, you know, quote-unquote rockers on the record. But so that's a funny comment saying that the Heartbreakers are finally rocking as hard as he's writing.
So we'll move on to Century City. We've touched on it briefly there before. The majority of the lyrics were written by Tom before the album sessions began. However, Century City was more closely related to the band's legal woes during production. So in a conversation with Paul Zollo for his book Conversations with Tom Petty, Tom said of the song, Century City was written during the record, certainly, because that's where I went for the lawyers and the lawsuits. So that was written then. So with that record, things were never the same. Things became very mega at that point. Do you feel that the song stands out for that reason? You were talking about, you know, even The Losers, for example, referencing stuff that was going on in his childhood, whereas Century City is very much in the present. It's to do with the wars that he's going through at that time with the label.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so funny. I've been in LA for the last, based out of there for the last 5 or 6 months, and I had a week or two where I was spending a decent amount in Century City, and I myself have been going through, you know, the woes of the music business and stuff, not to the same extent as Tom for sure, but it was really in those last few months that I like heard that song again and really connected with Tom on what he was saying. You know, that was for me, like when I initially listened to the record years and years ago, I think that was probably one of my least favorite songs, Century City. And I think, you know, like I said, lyrics are important for me. So it wasn't until I really had my own version of relatability to this song, because I liked the music, but I never quite, you know, I didn't know Century City, blah, blah, blah. And like, and then once you get that he's talking about the music business, it's hard to not catch on to every word that he says.
During those conversations with Tom, Paul Zollo comments, it's great that you got a song out of a dreadful experience. And I guess that's, you touched on this earlier on, actually, that it's something that we see on so many classic albums, that kind of from adversity and maybe trials and tribulations going on during the album's production come truly great songs. And as Paul said, you know, it's great that, you know, unfortunately Tom had to go through that experience. But I mean, the whole album's fantastic, but this song particularly centered around the issues he was having. You know, he's managed to write a great song out of it.
Yes, he has. I mean, that's to me what art is about, because there's no getting around shitty things in life. You know, it's about how you use it. And so Tom just is an artist through and through, and used his experience and made the best out of it and kicked their asses with a good record. So
Music Radar identify a Rolling Stones influence on Century City, highlighting Stan Lynch's punchy drumming and Mike Campbell's Keith-like guitar solo. This isn't the first time that we've mentioned the Rolling Stones tonight. Would you say that they're a big influence on the Heartbreakers, or do you think stuff like that's just coincidence?
No, I mean, I think when you listen to the two bands, there's definitely some similarities, mainly in just kind of like the like the vibe of the music. Like, I think like it's structurally and also just, you know, the bounce and the feel, you know, and like the rhythm. So like, you know, the drums are simple. The chords are, you know, pretty cool, but simple, you know, like there's like a simplicity to both of them, that I think that they share, a smart simplicity.
So we'll move on to Don't Do Me Like That. So this song has the longest history of any song on the album. It's one of the songs that started life as a song for Mudcrutch. After not making the cut on the first two albums, Tom Neely gave this song to the Jay Giles Band, which, while I can totally understand why he thought that they would do a great job with it, I think it's almost crazy that he wasn't particularly into doing it himself initially. And again, you know, an absolute highlight for me, but it just seems crazy that he Neely gave the song away.
Yeah, I had no idea that he had done that. But, you know, if something shakes your confidence in a song, you know, if he had done it with Mudcrutch and maybe they didn't receive the right response or something, you know, maybe that's why he did it. But yeah, this is a hands down killer song. And it's so fun to sing.
Peter Wolfe of the Jay Giles Band spoke to Rolling Stone about being offered the song by Tom. So he said, "One day I got this call from Jimmy's office confirming my address. I got this package and in it was a cassette. It was in Tom's handwriting, 'Don't Do Me Like That,' and there was a note. 'Hey, I think this would be a cool song for you. I think you and the Giles Band can really do something with it. It was in the midst of stuff. Maybe we thought we had the songs for our album. We can do it for the next one.' I called up Jimmy and I think Tom and said, 'Love the song. I'm not sure we're going to get to it, but I do like the song.' Tom wasn't sure of it of himself for some reason." And as I'd said, there's definitely a Jay Giles Band kind of vibe to it. I can totally understand why he would give it to them. And Tom said in the past that he felt it was a good representation of their sound.
Well, I mean, the verses definitely have that same kind of that attitude and like the same like kind of cadence that you'd expect Jay Giles Band to do. So I don't think he's wrong in that, but I sure do love his version.
Engineer Shelley Yakis revealed in an interview with Produce Like a Pro that for this one, the band tracked all together in the main live room using gobos to isolate guitar cabinets. This was a distinct way to record that was popular throughout the 60s and into the 70s, but it's waned a bit in recent years, as isolated sources have become the sound we associate with perfect production. Do you think that kind of reduction sorely missed? I mean, the previous episode to this one that we're doing today was about Synchronicity by The Police, where literally every member of the band was in a different room. So it's not as if Don't Do Me Like That sounds particularly dated from having everybody in the room, but obviously people moved away from that style eventually.
I'm a fan more of the open room sound. The isolation stuff, you know, I think you get a very precise tone with that. You have everything is very separated and singular, and you can kind of like stack things easier, and it doesn't sound blah, 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 blah. But Don't Do Me Like That and like the overall feel, I think, is enhanced by the room sound. I think that plays an important part in the melding of the instruments and why everything sounds so perfect.
So it was actually Jimmy Iovine who convinced Tom that he should keep the song, that he was determined that it would be a hit. And it's a good thing that he did, because it became the band's first big top 10 hit in the US. And as one of the singles from the album, it was a huge part in the album's breakthrough. Do you know, I'm guessing, is that a song that they, you know, has it become one of those tracks? You know, we were talking about top 10 Tom Petty tracks of all time and stuff. Is it one of those songs that ends up on those charts? Or do you think that as their career went through, it's a one that maybe got forgotten?
I think out of all of them, I think that would be the one that's kind of been forgotten. It's a great song, but it's not my absolute favorite. It probably wouldn't find its way into my top 10 of Tom's songs. You know, he went on to write some pretty badass songs, and even the ones from the previous two albums, there's some that I think have lasting power a little more so than Don't Do Me Like That. So yeah, I think it could totally have lost its place in the top 10. It's an incredible song, but I love a lot of his stuff.
I guess that's it. It's an incredible song, but there's so many incredible songs. So
good problem to have.
Yeah. We'll move on to You Tell Me. So You Tell Me is somewhat overlooked amongst the other great songs on the album we've been talking about. Music Radar highlights the performance of Ben Montench on this track and calls him the band's secret weapon. They say the Heartbreaker's secret weapon gets his moment in the sun here, sprinkling sweeping piano lines that meld with Hammond B3 swells to a stunningly effective degree. I know that you'd said early on, as soon as I mentioned his name, instantly you told me how much you loved him. How integral is he to the sound of the Heartbreakers?
Oh, he is the heart of the Heartbreakers. I don't think that any of their songs sound quite the same. And obviously on You Tell Me, it's a much more prevalent role. But even on the songs where he's a little bit more subdued, that underlying layer of usually the B3 organ, it adds so much depth and warmth to their sound that he's every bit important as, you know, Mike Campbell as Tom. I mean, they're all important, but Ben Mott's parts are like that thing that you didn't know you were missing, you know, or if it wasn't there, you'd be like, what's wrong?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously with them calling him the band's secret weapon, the implication there is that he's perhaps underrated. Would you agree with that? Do you think he, not just in the Heartbreakers, but just in general as a musician, do you think he's an underrated guy?
You know, it's hard for me to say because everyone that I know that loves Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers has nothing but mad respect for Ben Mott Tench. So in my view and in my camp, I don't think he's underrated. But maybe as a general whole, he could have used a little bit more attention for his playing, but I think anybody who knows what's up knows that Ben Mott is one of the best.
And I guess it's interesting, you know, that obviously some people who'll be listening to this maybe new to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers or more of a casual listener. And I think what's cool about that is that someone who is new to the band has so much more to discover because, you know, at the end of the day, Tom Petty's name's up there in the marquee, but all the members have something to contribute in making this a truly classic album. And Ben Mott absolutely is a huge part of that.
Definitely. He's a staple for sure.
So we'll move on to What Are You Doing In My Life? So Tom wrote this one about an annoying groupie in New York. So for a long time, the song was destined to be little more than an album track. But in conversation with Paul Zollo once again, Tom revealed that he actually revisited the song live back in 2004. And he'd said of What Are You Doing In My Life that it was better than I realised at the time. I wasn't that knocked out by it at the time, but when I played it at that show, I realised it was pretty durable. It held up really well. How do you feel the song's held up? Particularly, you know, talking about all these songs that we're saying how fantastic they are and how some of them have held up fantastically. How do you feel that this song holds up, bearing in mind that it is one of the lesser known songs on the album?
Oh, I mean, the whole album holds up. I don't think that there's one weak spot on it. But, you know, it definitely did fly under the radar. And I think it's not quite so pop off the record sounding, but it's held up brilliantly. I mean, it's a good question, you know, what are you doing in my life?
Music Radar single out the chorus. We've talked about the really strong choruses on this album. Music Radar single out the chorus of What You're Doing In My Life for praise, arguing that it's a chorus that you don't have to hear more than once to remember your entire life. And I think it's testament to the depth of this album that even these later tracks, you know, we've had a lot of the critically acclaimed tracks and the hits seem to have been earlier in the album, but even as we're getting towards the end of the album, and obviously we're close to Louisiana Rain now, our last track, and we still have these songs that are so strong with these really catchy choruses that they could very possibly have been hits too if the decision had been made to release them rather than Refugee.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, you know? It's like if they had just released this one, would we be talking about this one like we talk about Refugee, you know? Yeah, I mean, this one, every song is brilliant, but Louisiana Rain is such a beautiful song. So I think you're right. I think the tail end of this record, although it's not, you know, the hit heavy side, you know, it carries on the rest of the tone from the record of wonderful songwriting and badass musicianship.
So we'll move on to Louisiana Rain in just a minute. Shortly after his passing, An American Treasure, which was a retrospective box set of Tom Petty, was released last year. And it includes alternate versions of a few songs from Damn the Torpedoes, including What Are You Doing In My Life. Do you have American Treasure? Have you heard it? Have you heard this alternate version? And if you have, how does it differ to what we've heard on the album?
I haven't heard it yet. It's something I needed to go listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. I've yet to check it out myself, but it's something I'll certainly be doing. But we'll move on. We'll end the album with Louisiana Rain, a beautiful folk-tinged ballad that shows another side to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Again, it started life as a Mudcrutch song. And before work commenced on Damn the Torpedoes, Jimmy had gone through Mudcrutch's back catalogue and, along with Don't Do Me Like That, suggested to Tom that they re-record Louisiana Rain. I know you said it's a beautiful song. Do you think it was a wise idea for Jimmy? You say you've got more of a knowledge of Mudcrutch's songs. Do you think that it is a standout song from Mudcrutch? Is it a good choice to include to end the album?
I don't think Jimmy Iovine made any wrong decisions here. Yeah, I think I think this one was deserving of a re-recording. You know, I think sometimes you got to give some songs a second chance, and this one really handled it well. And it's, the melody is just, you know, it sucks you in. So I think Jimmy was right on.
Similar to Don't Do Me Like That, Tom was reluctant to include this at first, feeling that he'd already gone down that road. That's the quote I've got from him there. Unlike other songs on the album, such as Refugee, Louisiana Rain actually came together relatively quickly with few takes, unlike the 100 takes that Refugee, for example, took. Do you think that familiarity with the song from Them Red Crutch Days, does that make it easier when you're throwing these songs together? I was watching some stuff on Dark Side of the Moon the other night, and that because Pink Floyd had been playing those songs so much live, the process in the studio was that much easier, rather than trying to, with Refugee, for example, trying to get it right and get that sound right. With Louisiana Rain, obviously they played it so much, that likely sped up the process.
Oh yeah, that's going to speed up the process in the studio for sure. There's a huge difference between writing a song, you know, the week of or while you're in the studio and everybody getting familiar with it and recording it. Sometimes you can catch lightning in a bottle and you can get it, you know, like the second take, it's just got that right reckless abandonment, you know, like it's got the right shit. But most of the time, stuff's going to sound really good and be pretty easy to get if you've shed it live for years, you know. So that doesn't surprise me at all. It was a quick and painless process getting Louisiana Rain down.
So many people point to a Dylan-esque vibe on Tom's vocal delivery in Louisiana Rain. And of course, a lot of people have noted Bob Dylan's influence on Tom Petty over the years. And then, of course, they'd go on to work together as part of the Traveling Wilburys. How big an influence was Bob Dylan on Tom as they became friends and later bandmates? How did that relationship change?
Well, I think obviously they got closer, and I think, you know, went from Tom idolizing Bob Dylan and him being more of, you know, someone that he looks up to then becoming a peer. And then working together in Traveling Wilburys was magic. I mean, that's the best super group of all time, hands down. But yeah, it's interesting. I guess I could totally hear that twang on Louisiana Rain from Bob Dylan. It's funny how I didn't pick up on that myself, but could hear it.
So Louisiana Rain was a song that the Heartbreakers rarely played live. When Rolling Stone named it amongst its 10 best Tom Petty deep cuts in 2016, they revealed that Louisiana Rain had only been played 9 times, to their knowledge, by the Heartbreakers at least, most recently in 2013. Why do you think that is? And do you think that's possibly a missed opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's a missed opportunity, because I know that I would be singing along to every word if I was at a Tom Petty show and they whipped that one out. But, you know, maybe it was a special one that Tom wanted to keep in his pocket and only play when he, you know, felt like it, I guess. So more power to you, Tom.
Yeah.
If that's what you wanted to do.
How does Louisiana Rain end the album for you? I know you've said it's a beautiful song. What kind of job do you think it does in kind of closing the book on this album?
I think it does it in a perfect way. I think the album starts out really strong, and I'm a fan of when something starts out really strong, I like it to kind of come to a nice conclusion. And it has, you know, a lot of sweeter notes. And it's more of like a youthful kind of looking back and appreciating your youth type of song. So, you know, it's interesting because Century City is right in the middle. It's more of the present tense. And so I think he's ending with more of a reflection on his past, which is appropriate.
So it was the huge breakthrough that everyone predicted for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And it was only kept off the top spot in the US by Pink Floyd's The Wall. 40 years on, Damn the Torpedoes still sounds as urgent and current as ever, with both the hit singles and the deep cuts just as strong as each other. So AllMusic.com sums up the album's legacy perfectly. Amazingly, through all the frustration and anguish, Petty and the Heartbreakers delivered their breakthrough and arguably their masterpiece with Damn the Torpedoes. Musically, it follows through on the promise of their first two albums, offering a tough streamlined fusion of the Stones and Birds that, thanks to Jimmy Iovine's clean production, sounded utterly modern yet timeless. It helped that the Heartbreakers had turned into a tighter musical outfit, reminiscent of, well, the Stones, in their prime. All of the parts combine into a powerful, distinctive sound, capable of all sorts of subtle variations. Their musical suppleness helps bring out the soul in Petty's impressive set of songs. He had written a few classics before, but here his songwriting truly blossoms. With all that in mind, how and why does Damn the Torpedoes stand the test of time for you?
I think Damn the Torpedoes stands the test of time for me because, the pure content and the words that he was singing on this whole record really, I think, reflects a couple of different versions of him. It tells of his past, tells of his present. And I think it's also the where Tom kind of found his grit and kind of his fuck yous started coming through way more clearly, which is a huge part of the Tom Petty story. And I think this album will kind of forever stand out as his breaking point as a listener, you know, not just as, you know, commercially and successfully. I think when you listen through on the progression, you know, from start to finish, if you listen to all of his records, this one has a distinct tone and sound about it, and a freshness and a youthfulness that I think encapsulates Tom's vibe to his core.
And finally, why is Damn the Torpedoes your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Oh, well, it's my classic album because I've got family roots to it. I know every word to every song on the record. And I think you should check it out because if you are not the biggest Tom Petty fan, which if you haven't heard this record, you must not be. I think this is a really brilliant introduction to maybe have you think about him in some different lights, because there's some sneaky songs on here that'll stay with you that you might not have anticipated.
Well, Hannah, thank you very much for joining me to chat about this album. It's been lovely, haven't you? I was just kind of curious what's kind of going on for you at the minute. I know that you're coming over to the UK at some point soon, aren't you, on a UK tour?
I am. We're doing our first ever UK tour, the first, pretty much the beginning of October. So we've got 8 shows with a band called Gorilla Riot, and it's sponsored by Planet Rock Radio. So I'm ecstatic to make my way over to you guys.
Hannah Wicklin there, chatting with me about her chosen classic album, Damn the Torpedoes, by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Hannah is a very busy woman, very much in demand at the moment, so I'm very grateful that she found the time to come on the podcast. She is basically touring non-stop by the looks of things. If you go over to hannahwicklin.com, you'll see that Hannah Wicklin and the Stepping Stones have a very busy year in front of them. I've got a feeling they're going to be absolutely huge. I certainly hope so, they thoroughly deserve it. And as she touched on at the end there, she is going to be on a tour of the UK in October. So all those dates are over on hannahwicklin.com. And I know I usually say this for most people. I do mean it. I don't always get the opportunity. But I am going to try and get to her show in Newcastle if I can. So if I'm there, absolutely come and say hi. Unfortunately, time is up on another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks very much to Hannah. It's always really appreciated when people take the time to come on the show. Calvin Lever will be joining me in a couple of weeks' time to chat about the Black Album from Metallica. You know, as I said before, I'm very excited about that one. So join me in a couple of weeks as we talk all things Metallica. I'll see you then. Cheers.